The cyber landscape is constantly evolving, creating new challenges and opportunities to defend against sophisticated attacks. At Northrop Grumman, we provide a wide range of capabilities to stay ahead of these threats. To learn more, visit northropgrumman.com/cyber.
Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report's weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Later in the program, securing the supply chain. But first, joining us is Justin Sherman of the Atlantic Council's Cyber Statecraft Initiative and a contributor to Wired Magazine to discuss a new piece that he co-authored with Trey Hare, who heads the Council's Cyber Statecraft Initiative. Their piece, Finding a Foreign Policy for the Internet, ran recently in the National Interest. Justin, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And before we get started, our daily podcast is sponsored by Bell. Leonardo DRS sponsors our global coverage. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our coverage of naval warfare. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Justin, you guys make a great case, and I commend everybody to read the piece because it is very thoughtful, that the United States and, in fact, the international community sort of lack some sort of real global norms and rules of the road, which countries have been trying to take, have been taking advantage of, whether it's China or Russia. The last administration's approach to almost everything was China is bad and it must be stopped. The Clean Networks Initiative was get China's technology off the internet, which wasn't very practicable. And a lot of our allies and partners have pushed back on that. Meanwhile, Beijing has been extremely active to try to shape the internet and standards bodies to its liking. The Biden administration wants to bring allies and partners together for sort of a collective approach to China, but also to craft what are these sort of modern norms that we need that countries like China and Russia are trying to exploit. And I should note the Cyber Solarium Commission also is highlighting in its next 2 years the importance of, for example, the State Department's Cyber Bureau. Talk to us about what the problem is with the current system that needs to be fixed.
Our argument is that the U.S. currently lacks a coherent and cohesive foreign policy for the internet. It lacks a positive vision for what a future democratic internet looks like from the U.S. perspective. And this is both a huge problem and a huge opportunity for the U.S. right now, for several of the reasons that you mentioned. We have an unprecedented authoritarian assault on the free and open internet from governments all around the world, particularly Moscow and Beijing. And Beijing especially has been pouring millions and billions of dollars into cyber capacity building around the world, into changing the internet's technical standards by working in standards bodies, investing in shaping internet norms at the UN. So there's a massive amount of effort going into shaping how the internet looks and behaves. And at the same time, we have a crisis of governance to some extent of the internet in many democracies, where countries that have historically been pretty hands-off the internet are increasingly looking at harms like disinformation, hate speech, pervasive cyber insecurity, and deciding that they need to do more to address those harms, but perhaps they're not sure what exactly they need to do and what the right balance of regulation in a democratic internet model looks like. And so we have all of these things going on. And yet, as you highlighted, and as we discuss in the essay, the past 5 years of US policy and messaging toward the internet have pretty much just said, don't do what China's doing. It has been positioned in contrast to Beijing's authoritarian internet control, surveillance, censorship. It's been positioning against the Chinese government's heavy-handedness in digital markets in China. It's all positioned in that not China framing. And while there are parts of that that I think are good things to pursue, right? Like we should continue to oppose the technological authoritarianism, we should continue to oppose the government exerting strong control over tech companies. What we're left with, though, is no positive vision for what the alternative looks like. We're so fixated on describing what we should not do that we don't actually describe what we should do. We don't offer a new vision for what other countries can get behind for what a democratic internet looks like. And that's really our argument in the essay, is that's what the US has the opportunity right now to create.
I want to get to that in a moment. You mentioned China, for example, in the United Nations. China's fingers are also on international bodies in Switzerland and in London and all around the world. Tell the audience a little bit, what are some of the things that China is doing perniciously, right? Because you guys make a note that small, seemingly small things can have very, very big impacts at the end of the day. What are some of the things that China is doing that we, you know, that the entire audience should be wise to as we look at this global commons and how Beijing is trying to co-opt it?
Yeah, there are many ways that Beijing is working to act in international bodies to undermine the global and open internet. And to be very clear, that's not to suggest that the Chinese government wants some sort of domestic intranet that's totally cut off from the rest of the world, because that's not the case. But they do want to rewrite both the technical rules that govern the global internet, as well as the norms and laws that shape its use in their favor in more authoritarian ways. And so the United Nations is one forum in which we see that. For about two decades, several authoritarians, including the Chinese and Russian governments, have been introducing these proposals that essentially work to justify internet repression under this fig leaf claim of fighting cybercrime or fighting cyberterrorism. And those efforts have failed time and time again. The US and other democracies have successfully built coalitions and voted those down. And yet, if we look at what happened during the Trump administration, there were actually a couple of those that advanced. And there was notably in 2019, one of those that passed. This was described to me for a Wired story I did last year as an embarrassing and stunning defeat by one of the people who used to lead these US efforts at the UN. It was an example of how the Chinese government is advancing its internet repression in forums where the US was suddenly taking a back seat and there was this leadership vacuum. So the UN's one example, but the Chinese government has worked through the Shanghai Cooperation Organization to advance internet repression norms in Asian countries. It has worked in the ITU, which is the UN's technical standards setting body, to try and make internet standards development more state controlled. So instead of the voluntary, open, private sector led stuff we've had for 20, 30 years, it's pushing instead to have governments have a greater say in how the internet works, which again, of course, is to consolidate the Chinese government's power. And so there's all of these vectors in which it's occurring, but this is why it's all the more urgent for the US to come with a coherent way to respond to these assaults.
And speaking of that, excellent cueing, Justin. It's always a pleasure having you having you on. So what's the strategy the new administration need to guarantee what you guys refer to as sort of the five fundamentals, right, of the internet? Freedom, openness, interoperability, security, and resilience. What does this new strategy need to look like, this new foreign policy?
Yeah, the five principles are a huge point. And to this, credit goes to my co-author, Robert Morges. Back when he and I were at New America, we wrote a report called The Idealized Internet Versus Internet Realities. And this is where we went back through years and years of US government documents on the internet, as well as those in other democracies, and found that even though definitions varied slightly and uses varied slightly, democracies, especially the US, have long discussed these five principles around the internet: freedom, openness, interoperability, security, and resiliency. And so that's what Trey and I discuss in this essay, is in order to understand where we're at today, in order to advance this coherent foreign policy for the internet, the first thing we have to do is we have to reevaluate what those principles look like today. Because of course, it's great to speak in theory about a free internet, but the reality is it's relatively free, because some countries have very aggressive censorship policies, but even democracies have some limitations on content, right? In the US, on child porn, on pirated media, for example. So security obviously is another one where there are massive shortfalls from the ideal. So you have to go through and evaluate the state of play today. But Trey and I argue that there's really three components to revitalizing this foreign policy, and they're not the only three, but they're important. The first is remembering that the internet is about people. So for all of the technical stuff we can talk about, it's people at private companies deciding what cables to build and how to route data. It's people in technical standards bodies who are combating these authoritarian standards proposals. It's the users that rely on the internet, right? These people form an incredibly essential element of the internet ecosystem. And so when we're talking about what the US needs to do and what the internet should look like, we can't forget these broader economic and political and social forces. So that's the first point. The second point we make is that we should start with small policy interventions and then iterate on them. So instead of waiting for the US Congress, for example, to come up with some enormous consensus regulatory overhaul of big tech or something of that nature, it's better to pick particular issues and start rapidly iterating in small ways, because with the diverse array of stakeholders we have on the internet and the internet's complexity, that's just probably the best way to have outsized impact. So one specific example is Section 230 reform. We offer in there that it's probably better to do small, rapid iterations rather than wait for some massive overhaul to happen all at once. Same thing on securing internet protocols, right? The rules we all use to route data, to send emails, that kind of thing. Rather than trying to make companies secure all of them at once, we're better off targeting discrete things like the domain name system and then working from there. So that's our second point, is to start small and then iterate. And the third and final argument we make is that policymakers and practitioners have to accept that there's no going back. And this goes back to the five principles, right? We're not going to be able to go back to the internet of 2000. We're not going to be able to go back to the internet of 2010, even when there was this sort of techno-centrist delusion in the US even that social media would topple dictatorships and, you know, could never be weaponized by autocracies. And so in order to actually advance this policy, we argue you have to confront disinformation, cyber insecurity. We have to confront these realities and the fact that we have to do something about them, even if we've been pretty hands off the web in the past. So those are sort of our three components of how to start building this cohesive foreign policy for the internet.
Talk to us about what, you know, you mentioned that even democracies have tried things that have just not worked very well, right? I mean, Germany, for example, in its battle against extremism, we've seen this in France, we've seen it in New Zealand, in India, and even in the United States, right? What does the new administration have to bear in mind about what works and doesn't work in trying to control what ultimately becomes free speech in free societies, right? To a degree. Right.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, this is right. This is something that's, of course, getting a lot of discussion in the internet speech context with everything that happened from the election to the coup attempt and all these other things with social media companies' responsibilities. We have to remember that these are private platforms, and this is an important point across in private companies. This is an important point across, you know, speech, but also security and other issues, right? Because the First Amendment does not apply to Twitter and Facebook because they're private companies. They can take the moderation decisions that they would like to take. Similarly, you know, the internet's physical architecture in the US is predominantly controlled by the private sector. The government cannot just go in and say, you need to do X, Y, and Z to make it more secure, or here's this exact configuration we want you to do so that the internet is more resilient in the case of, let's say, a big DDoS attack, like with the Mirai botnet in 2016. So we have to remember, first and foremost, that a lot of this is going to come back to a blend of, yes, regulation in some cases, regulatory enforcement in some cases, but also public-private engagement, partnerships, collectives, ways for the government to shape incentives for the private sector. So it's not saying here's this particular internet security standard that you need to use that we won't update and then will be outdated, but instead trying to shape the incentives for the private sector to invest more in securing core internet infrastructure from the outset, for example. So I think that's really one of the most interesting and complex spaces that this administration and future ones will have to play in.
Let me ask you really briefly about a little bit about the Shultz Doctrine, former Secretary of State George Shultz, one of America's great statesmen, passed away recently. And one of the elements of the Shultz Doctrine, for what it is that, right, technology will work against tyrannical leadership, right? That ultimately these kind of novel forms of communication will make repression harder. We've seen, however, China and Russia, right, go to more flexible models and figure out how to use these tools as means of national control, potentially dangerously. Ultimately, do they succeed? Because history has shown that actually autocracies and tyrannical regimes like this actually eventually collapse under their own weight. Any sense on what direction that's going in? Because there is a lot of pent-up frustration, for example, even in China, right, that we have a tendency of sometimes not seeing, where a much more open society is becoming much more closed. And it's not like the people in that society don't recognize that that's happening, nor frankly like it.
I don't know if we can predict. I mean, I don't think we really can predict, of course, and I don't want to make specific predictions, but I think what I'll say is that you raise interesting questions. And I think what's happened in the US is we've gone from one extreme to the other in terms of how we view the relationship between the internet and democracy and authoritarianism. And the reason I say that is because if we think back to the Arab Spring, where there was a blend of offline mobilization, online mobilization, sharing of photos to the international community, and there was also really a blend of not just Twitter and Facebook, but local blogs in Iran, for example, and other things. The narrative in the US was, oh, look, Twitter revolution. Oh, look, the internet topples authoritarians. This is great. Right. So this sort of became the view. As you hinted, that did not come out of nowhere. Shultz wrote about that in the 80s, I think it was, with autocracies not being able to exert total control in that way. This was actually in the Bush National Security Strategy, I think in 2006, where they said that political control and economic vitality cannot exist in tandem. But we had that view where the internet was an inherently democratic force, it was liberating the world, and that it couldn't be weaponized by those same governments, even though that was already happening during the Arab Spring. I think now we've flipped way the other way on this binary poll, where we had 2016 happen and all of a sudden people were asking this very binary question, does technology help or hurt democracy? And there was all this concern about disinformation and things of that nature, cyber attacks, and how the internet was actually a danger to democracies. Similarly, with the point you raise about discontent in China, I would also add, of course, with all the protests going on, discontent in Russia, I think there's been a bit of an extreme pivot there too, where there's been a lot of focus on, oh, Beijing completely controls the web. There's no way you can say anything in there. Russia has an authoritarian hold on the internet. And they certainly do engage in extensive internet repression. But that, again, in going to that other poll, I think ignores the gray in the middle, which you're getting at, which is, well, they can use it for control in some ways, but people can still use VPNs. They can use encrypted messaging apps. People can organize online. They can share discontents in local chats and things like this. So I don't know if that answers your question, but all to say, I think what many people are coming to grips with is the reality, which is that it's actually very gray in terms of how the internet helps or hurts these different regimes. And we have to think about these technologies in that broader political context.
Thanks so very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Already looking forward to having you back on. And joining us now is John Cofrancesco of Fortress Information Security, an Orlando-based firm that specializes in cyber supply chain security. John, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Start us off, John. The National Institutes for Standard and Technology, that is the governing body for cyber standards in the United States, has new standards out. Not to be too repetitive on that statement, talk to us about what this new NIST standard means for cybersecurity in the industry?
Well, supply chain security, and as NIST calls it, cyber supply chain security, is becoming the hottest topic for a variety of really good reasons. And NIST specifically, who's been following this for a long time, has come out and laid out a basically an 8-point plan of how you can take your organization and really get them up to speed from a supply chain and cyber supply chain security perspective. Well, I'm going to water down those 8 steps into really three parts to just keep it easy. The first thing is you have to have somebody appointed to deal with this. We're finding a lot of these organizations, for economic reasons, just don't have somebody in charge. And as a result, they're really exposed. The second thing that NIST is telling us to do is you have to be looking at cyber supply chain security throughout the entire life cycle. So you need to understand where that thing came from, the asset that you're putting into your network, what you're going to do with it while it's with you, and then how you're going to matriculate it out of your system when it comes to end of life. So really, from the very start, the inception to the very end, you have to have vision. And then the third thing that they're really asking folks to do is to collaborate. And I think this is by far the hardest one, because they're really saying, hey, you got to work with your vendors and the vendor of your vendors. And as you are likely to be a vendor yourself, you need to be working with your clients, because there really aren't digital perimeters today.
And so how do we do that, right? So in the wake of SolarWinds, we've talked to everybody from Chris Inglis to Mike Rogers, as well as Angus King and Mike Gallagher of the Solarium Commission on how to do this better, how to secure the supply chain. Suzanne Spaulding joined us the week before last to have that conversation as well. In the wake of the Tampa water attack and SolarWinds, what is the kind of partnership that's necessary in order to do it, right? I mean, everybody talks about public-private partnership, but at the end of the day, we're still getting whacked on a very, very regular basis that shows the magnitude of the exposure we have. And that supply chain vulnerability is how a lot of these guys are getting into these networks.
So we're fighting blind right now, and that's why we're getting whacked so often. The very first thing we need to do, both on the government side and on the industry side, is to get vision of the supply chain. And that really means doing the tough thing, digging down into the bill of materials, which, by the way, NIST is telling us to do as well, to understand what is the origin of the things we're bringing on network, what's the provenance of those things and the folks delivering them to us. And as an extension of that, sharing that data. And that's something at Fortress that we've really led the way on, is both illuminating the supply chain, but also sharing the data.
Everybody, I think, understands now the SolarWinds attack, and they've heard about what happened with Tampa Water. Was anything new or particularly interesting to you about the Tampa Water attack?
There isn't anything new from an attack vector perspective. We've known for a long time that this is the way the our near-peer adversaries want to get in, bad actors want to get in. There's one big difference, is that this is getting media attention. And that might be because old Tampa Tom brought home a Super Bowl in the same week this attack happened, or it might be because people are waking up to the nature of this threat. But I'm very hopeful that this vision on this issue is really going to result in some positive changes.
The new administration is looking at where to go with CMMC, the Cybersecurity Maturity Model certification process that the Trump administration began. How do you think the approach has to change? What parts of CMMC to keep, what parts of CMMC to change as the department, as DOD, looks to improve its overall cybersecurity?
So I don't think I'm breaking any news here when I say that the Trump and Biden administrations really couldn't be further from each other on basically every issue, with this one exception. And in fact, I expect that the Biden administration will take a stronger position and ought to take a stronger position on CMMC. We ought to look at CMMC as a first step. Obviously, as many of the listeners will know, it has been somewhat controversial because it can be an impediment to business. But we have to get serious about this, and we have to get serious about it now. And the Biden administration needs to make sure that CMMC is rolled out faster and more vigorously than the Trump administration had initially planned to do.
When you say to get serious about it, right? I mean, at the end of the day, we have looked at cybersecurity as an obligation of whoever wants to protect their intellectual capital, right? We have put standards in place, but there aren't really any enforcement bodies. The Cyber Solarium Commission has looked at how to implement tougher standards to actually make companies, for example, responsible for their cybersecurity and to disclose cyber vulnerabilities, right? I mean, all too often, companies have chosen to keep their mouths quiet, so then people don't know really the magnitude of the damage that's been done and the loss of intellectual capital. Do we need to turn this, John, into more fire safety standards and have them be enforceable at the end of the day? Because this is costing everybody money, everybody time, right? You're only as strong as your weakest link. And there are a lot of weak links there because this stuff is expensive. The threat keeps changing. And smaller companies sometimes don't want, or even larger companies, frankly, haven't wanted to invest the kind of money that's necessary. I know that's kind of a really self-serving question for a company that does this, right? But what has to change in order to change this? Because no matter how much we talk about it, we're not really improving security, it doesn't seem.
Well, I think this waters down to dollars and cents. People have, you know, sort of raised the right hand, swore that they were going to do the right thing, and then they don't because the government hasn't forced them for economic reasons to do it. And I get it. I'm a business first guy myself. It's very hard to spend money on a cost center when you have plenty of value center places you want to invest. But this is an area where if we don't get our handle on this, we are creating an existential threat to our country. You know, in the last century, the communists had this proverb, but it's often been associated with Lenin, though there's no evidence that he actually said it, but the proverb goes that the capitalists will sell us the rope that we'll use to hang them. In this century, there's a new dynamic. They're selling us the ropes that they're hanging us with. So not only are they hanging us, but they're selling us the ropes. It's doubly bad. So the way to get out in front of this is to make sure that government agencies are not buying from organizations who aren't cybersecure. And until that happens, nothing will change. So really important to make sure that government is not purchasing from folks for the sole purpose that they're cyber weak. And to sort of take the second half of the question, I think it's important to talk about small businesses and big businesses in the space. Fortress and organizations like ours are creative. We're driving down the cost of doing this type of compliance. Just 2 years ago, this would have been unaffordable. But today, organizations can absolutely, big or small, really bring themselves into compliance in the right way.
And in many respects, right after the Russian Revolution, major American corporations did set up and help industrialize Russia, including Ford Motor Company and others. Let me ask you one last question in the brief amount of time we have left. Nicole Perlroth, the New York Times cyber reporter, recently wrote that one of the challenges and one of the problems is that the United States is focused too much on cyber offense and not enough on cyber defense. I mean, do you think that at the end of the day, that's one of the challenges that we've sort of lacked? You know, we've thought that offense is the best defense. And at the end of the day, defense might be the best defense, right? I mean, you do need an offensive component to this. But at the end of the day, right, improving your own security, you know, you have to have some kind of fortification, right?
I actually happen to think she's half right. So I think she's absolutely right in that we haven't invested enough into defense. But I don't think we ought to do that at the cost of offense. I think because of the nature of how leadership works in this country, and particularly on the DOD side, the folks who are in charge tend to think of kinetic offense and defense first and then cyber second. The reality is we're not in a hot war and we're not in a cold war. We're in a cyber war. But so maybe we should buy one less aircraft carrier and put that $7, $8, $10 billion into new offensive and defensive cyber spending. So just all around the board, our cyber spending is way, way below what it ought to be. And making sure that we have both fully funded and completely spun up is what we need to do. And I'm hopeful that the Biden administration is going to do that.
John, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Everyone is a contributor at Northrop Grumman, and every day is an opportunity to help defend our nation and our allies. Visit our careers page at ngc.com to learn about joining the Cyber and Intelligence Mission Solutions team.